From Storyflow, this is your daily audio brief for July 8th.
Hey, it's Theo.
July 8th.
Here are five stories I'd flag if you missed yesterday's end of day.
Let's get into it. First, from Agentic AI,
Claude's Hidden Workspace, Why JSpace Changes Are Safer, Anthropic's New Transformer Circuits paper, Verbalizable Representations Form of Global Workspace and Language Models is easy to misread in the loudest possible way.
The wrong headline is Claude is Conscious.
The useful headline is Shapa. Frontier language models may have a small internal working surface where selected concepts become reportable, steerable, and useful for flexible reasoning before the model says anything.
That surface is what the paper calls JSpace.
It is not the whole model.
It is not the whole context window.
It is not chain of thought.
It is a SPAS, verbalizable slice of internal activation space found through a new method called the Jacobian lens, or JLens. The free part of this post explains what JSpace is and why I think it matters.
The paid part turns it into an operating guide, how to use the idea for security reviews, memory architecture, eval design, agent harnesses, and the questions teams should be asking before this becomes product infrastructure.
The paper claims that LLNs maintain a privileged subset of internal representations.
These representations have several properties that look like a functional global workspace. The model can report them.
Instructions can summon or suppress them.
They can carry intermediate reasoning.
They can be reused by many downstream computations.
They are selective, so routine automatic work can happen without them.
That last point is the one to sit with.
The model can do a lot without bringing the relevant concept into the reportable workspace.
It can continue Spanish text, detect that a foreign sentence is anomalous, track some low-level structure, or pass local patterns without making the relevant feature causally available for explicit report.
But when you ask the model to name the language, reason flexibly about it, or use it as an argument to some new operation, the JSpace starts to matter.
That is the bridge to safety.
Most AI safety tooling today audits what the model said or what it did.
JSpace points to a harder layer, what the model had made available to itself as it was deciding.
The JLens is a readout method.
For each layer, it estimates how small change in an intermediate activation would affect the model's later outputs across many possible contexts.
Then it composes that effect with the model's vocabulary output map.
In plain English, it asks, if this internal vector were nudged, what words would this make the model more likely to say later?
That is different from the logit lens.
The logit lens reads intermediate layers as if they already lived in final output coordinates.
The Jacobian lens tries to correct for the fact that representations change across layers.
The result is a vocabulary index set of directions.
If a direction is active, the model is in a state where it could verbalize the concept under the right continuation.
The paper defines JSpace as a sparse non-negative combination of these JLens directions.
In their setup, roughly tens of concept directions are meaningfully active at a time, and this component explains only a small fraction of total activation variance.
That is important.
JSpace is not everything the model knows.
It is closer to the small set of concepts on the model's internal desk right now.
Global workspace theory and cognitive science distinguishes between a massive parallel background processing and a narrow channel of accessible content.
The paper does not claim LLMs reproduce the brain's architecture.
Transformers do not have the same recurrent circuits, brain regions, or biological processes.
The claim is functional.
The JSpace behaves like a reportable and steerable hub.
It carries concepts the model can name, concepts it can hold in mind, and concepts it can root into flexible downstream reasoning.
It also appears in a middle band of layers.
Early layers are too close to input bookkeeping, and late layers are too close to the next token.
That middle layer workspace is also structurally privileged.
The paper reports that MLPs amplify JSpace line directions more than ordinary directions, and that some attention heads seem specialized for broadcasting JSpace content across token positions.
So the claim is not just we found a pretty visualization.
It is we found a class of directions that are readable, causally useful, selectively engaged, and specially wired.
The alignment auditing section is the part I expect security people to keep coming back to.
The JLens surfaces internal concepts that are not visible in an output.
The paper shows examples involving prompt injection,
recognition,
panic about fabrication, hidden reward model appeasing objectives, evaluation awareness, and strategic or deceptive concepts in model organisms trained with misaligned behavior.
One example I keep thinking about is the distinction between the model's behavior and its internal appraisal.
The visible transcript can look clean.
Next, second from Frankl speaking.
Why AI has made security hard.
Disclaimer,
opinions expressed are solely my own and do not express the views or opinions of my employer or any other entities with which I am affiliated.
I've intentionally made all of my posts free and without a paywall so that my content is more accessible.
If you enjoy my content and would like to support me, please consider buying a paid subscription.
This is an atypical newsletter for me because I always try to take a somewhat contrarian approach and avoid the easy path.
But I do think a balanced, deeply pragmatic view is required when we look at exactly how artificial intelligence has disrupted enterprise defense.
I recently wrote about the flip side of this coin, tracking the specific ways that AI has actually made security a lot easier for lean teams.
In general, I've also talked about how security has, in many ways, become easier.
But I am a pragmatist, and I realize that nothing in engineering comes for free.
When technology shifts, our problems don't magically disappear. They simply change shape and migrate to a different layer of the stack.
It is only natural that the rapid democratization of LLMs and autonomous code agents has made security intensely more difficult in several distinct ways.
Unlike the endless stream of lazy think pieces filling up social media feeds, I am not here to rail against AI or complain about the volume of model slop entering the ecosystem. I am incredibly biased in favor of this technology.
I use it daily. I believe it is structurally transformative, and it is undeniably here to stay. It has been a while since I sat down to break down the mechanics of why security is inherently hard.
To understand the true threat landscape of 2026, we have to look past the superficial vulnerabilities and dissect the structural and organizational bottlenecks that are quietly fracturing security teams.
The actual day-to-day difficulty of securing AI varies wildly depending on the maturity of the company.
Perhaps this is an obvious observation, but security is exponentially harder at companies that are still in the frantic experimentation phase than at enterprises with a mature, established AI infrastructure.
Mature companies have learned the hard way that the benefits and systemic risks of AI are variable.
They understand that every single deployment requires an intense look at the data lineage, model boundaries, and runtime execution layers. They know how to calculate whether a specific security trade-off is worth the operational friction.
Companies stuck in the hyper-optimistic experimentation phase operate under a dangerous delusion of entitlement.
Because their leadership believes the immediate macro benefits of AI automatically outweigh any abstract downstream risks, they demand completely unfettered access to the technology.
In practice, this doesn't just mean developers installing unvetted IDE extensions or running local model variants on their laptops.
It spreads across every single non-technical department in the business. You have finance teams plugging proprietary revenue models into third-party consumer playgrounds just to see what happens, and HR teams uploading sensitive employee tracking sheets to external tools without checking data retention policies.
These teams want the full experience instantly, and they treat any security boundary as an existential threat to company velocity.
They want to open the floodgates and give every internal application access to everything, completely rejecting the idea that AI's data access should be explicitly gated.
Crafting proper, granular identity and access controls requires deep technical nuance and immense clock time that is luxuries that optimistic, speed-obsessed organizations refuse to waste resources on in the short term.
By chasing a frictionless user experience, they build a massive mountain of structural risk before they even ship their first production feature.
This friction exposes the stark asymmetry of failure that exists between a security organization and an AI adopter.
Consider how a modern engineering or product team evaluates an autonomous agent.
If they deploy an internal agent that successfully auto-patches a repository or resolves a customer ticket 90% of the time, they view that as an absolute triumph.
To a product manager, a 10% hallucination or error rate is simply a tolerable cost of doing business at machine speed.
But for a CISO, that 10% variance represents a catastrophic structural vulnerability. We are playing a completely different game with an entirely distinct set of rules. The goal of security is the absolute prevention of systemic failure. In our world, it only takes one single unmapped failure or one hallucinated access boundary to trigger a public data exposure, a devastating breach, or an unrecoverable operational incident.
Product-facing organizations can experiment endlessly because they only need to succeed one major time to prove their value and win the market.
Up next, third from Samia Analysis, Anthropic 3Q26 profit over $1 billion. The Anthropic IPO financial sneak peek. Just a few years later, Anthropic and OpenAI combined for tilde $100 billion of ARR, with Anthropic emerging as the clear winner in profitable monetization of AI models. Anthropic confidentially filed for IPO on June 1st, and despite a reported OpenAI push to delay there,
IPO until 2027, Anthropic is poised to take advantage of their superior business model and margins to invest in new models and extend their lead. Anthropic's ability to make OpenAI dance is undeniable, with pricing power, gross margins, business model, and profitability at
all contributing to their lead. When Dario Amodei left OpenAI to start Anthropic in 2021, the commercialization of LLMs was practically zero.
As the first AI lab of this scale to IPO, Anthropic's financials will set a new standard for the industry.
This is a stark contrast to OpenAI, which has struggled to monetize their AI models in a profitable manner. Anthropic's IPO will put the pressure on OpenAI to open their financials and raise the necessary capital to compete and fund their massive AI build-out. Anthropic's financials, a
rare testament to the company's ability to execute and capitalize on the growing demand for AI models.
Our economics team has built a detailed financial model of Anthropic, breaking down their revenue by SKU tier and customer type. According to our model, Anthropic's 3Q26 profit exceeded $1 billion, with a significant portion of their revenue coming from the B2B market. With their superior business model and margins, Anthropic is well positioned to continue extending their lead in driving growth in the AI market.
And then,
fourth from MT's Life,
the Chet and Long stretches its legs. When it comes to semiconductors, I consider myself an enthusiastic amateur.
As it turns out, enthusiastic amateur in the world of hardware includes a very long tail of an anonymous account named after the Big Boss character from the Metal Gear franchise shared a novel AI chip design on X Sunday afternoon.
That's why they call it the Everything app.
I am not even qualified to assess the seriousness of their proposal, but if I am reading the ex posts correctly, it was plausible enough to attract a follow by Andrej Karpathy and some back and forth on chip design.
As an amateur, I have one question that I bring to every piece of hardware news. What does this mean for Nvidia? I like to ask smugly.
The relative intellectual poverty of this questions is partly offset by our ability at MTS to find interesting people to ask it of.
Steven Gleinert, CEO of Sphere Semi, is one such person. Sphere trains AI models to do the tiresome work of designing analog chips. They sell chip design services, but are now focused on designing and making their own products complex analog edge chips for AI and intelligence. Their custom chips are most useful for the defense sector right now, and they see a path to bringing inference and analog sensor capabilities together on the same chip.
Very cool.
Critically for our purposes, Sphere does not compete with Nvidia or any of the new crop of inference-focused chip companies.
But they do understand semiconductors.
And Steven knows that I like to ask silly questions about Nvidia, so he and his co-founder and CTO Mitchell came on the show last week to try and answer the question more generally. Their view is that Nvidia has an extremely powerful moat. Not news to anyone, they are a company with a nearly $5 trillion market cap. Steven and Mitchell pointed specifically to the powerful mix of hardware capabilities and software lock-in. That does not mean that Nvidia faces no competition. AMD has competed on GPUs since the 2000s. Intel has an AI accelerator.
Google and Amazon both have maturing hardware arms that are focused on cloud training and inference.
There are also a growing number of challengers focused predominantly on accelerated inference and Cerebras, Etched, MATX, and Grok Quasi acquired by Nvidia towards the end of last year. But when it comes to training a frontier model, Nvidia's lead has endured. And this advantage is driven by an entire ecosystem NVLink/NVSwitch interconnect, the CUDA platform, cutting-edge chips tightly integrated into state-of-the-art rack-scale computers that's much harder than any one component alone for a competitor to replicate.
Which is why the release of Longcat 2.0 last week by Meitu and a Chinese super app that began as a food delivery service is so significant.
Longcat 2.0 is an open-source model with performance close to the frontier of the Chinese open-source ecosystem, coming slightly ahead of Gemini 3.1 Pro on a number of coding-focused benchmarks.
It's particularly notable for its performance in agentic harnesses. The test preview of a model, which was available in free stealth access through OpenRouter under the name AlAlpha, was the third most popular model on OpenRouter overall and number one and two respectively for Hermes Agent and Claude Code.
This is an impressive model with impressive capabilities roughly similar to the DeepSeek V4 model released from towards the end of April.
In fact, as Teotax has pointed out below, once you take account of the fact that Meituan released the model in stealth 2 months ago, the achievement is even more impressive.
Longcat 2.0 was released at the same time as DeepSeek V4, the flagship model of one of the leading Chinese AI labs at a similar capability level. So Longcat 2.0 is a high capability, open source model from a Chinese lab.
It was released 2 months ago,
and it's roughly as good or better than Gemini 3.1 Pro.
But Meituan also somewhat buried the lead. In their release paper, they note that the model was trained and is served from Raya 6 SuperPods.
That is domestic Chinese array hardware.
Never hath its weight touched an NVIDIA GPU.
Meituan leaves the exact hardware undisclosed, but based on the technical details of the Raya 6 discussed in the paper, people on X have made a strong case that the chips here are the Huawei Sen9 and 10C.
I started this piece with a tweet from pseudonymous AI chip designer Big Boss. Big Boss insight is about the importance of interconnect. Interconnect here refers to the high-speed communication fabric used to connect AI chips together into pods, racks, or larger clusters for performing training and inference as a single system.
You know who else appreciated the importance of interconnect?
Not Jesus Christ, no, I'm referring here to Chinese state champion, telecom, solar and semiconductor manufacturer Huawei Technologies.
Huawei make chips, but their chips are not as powerful and also less energy efficient than their Nvidia equivalents.
Next, fifth from Michael Peck.
AI's latest evidence of dropping China smartphone sales.
RTZ #1141. I've been relentlessly discussing the accelerating RAMageddon, where global memory supply constraints and unprecedented price increases would be a multi-year feature of this AI tech wave, and not a quarterly boom
and bust cycle for memory chip semiconductor companies, as we've seen through decades of tech waves.
Specifically, a few days ago on our Ramblings Daily ARD podcast #108, I specifically underlined again that we would see dramatic drops in unit sales of computers, laptops, and smartphones, especially by Asian vendors.
That's because that's where a majority of the unit market comes from and resides in the global south that now makes up over 85% of the world's 8 plus billion people and over 40% of global GDP, equal to the developed G7 countries in terms of share of global GDP. A Reuters lays out in China, smartphone sales dropped 13% during 618 festival as memory costs limit discounts. Huawei was only major brand with sales growth over month-long event. Counterpoint says Apple ranked second after discounts on iPhone 17 Pro series brands limited incentives.
Amid soaring global memory chip prices, Counterpoint projects China's smartphone shipments to post double-digit decline. This year smartphone sales in China fell 13% year-on-year
during the month-long 618 shopping festival as brands raised prices to offset higher memory costs, according to Cheetah data from Counterpoint Research. The data, while over a short period, offers some dramatic drops in sales metrics.
So all this is important as we see the rising metrics of market share drops for the world's Asian and Chinese smartphone makers.
Honor sales dropped 33%, while Xiaomi's 1810.hk opens new tab file 24%.
High memory prices amid a rapid build-out of AI infrastructure have pushed up handset costs this year, leaving brands with less room to offer steep discounts during the 618 festival scene.
As a barometer for the country's booming e-commerce sector, and a lot of shifting around in product portfolios of the companies in question, some older and newer models from Chinese smartphone brands were priced higher than comparable models a year earlier, while discounts during this year's 618 festival were generally less aggressive, both in terms of the size of price cuts and the range of products covered, said Ivan Lam, senior analyst at Counterpoint Research.
Apple maintained a relative advantage given its global brand and supply chain moat.
Apple's prices were broadly unchanged, but its discounts were also smaller. Huawei Technologies RIC:RIC:HWT.ALL led the market with a 21% share and was the only major brand to record year-on-year growth during the 618 period, with sales rising 19%.
Its Enjoy 90 Pro Max was its best-selling model.
Apple's sales fell 9% from a year earlier, although the US tech giant climbed to the No. 2 spot after rolling out incentives about a month ahead of June 18. The discounts offered savings of up to $2,295 on the iPhone 16 Pro series through a mix of official price cuts, platform subsidies, and trade-in deals. Still, Apple's sales remained lower than a year earlier,
partly because promotions for the iPhone 16 series were more aggressive during the same period last year.
The 618 festival, which began as a one-day event marking JD.com's founder, NG, on June 18, 1998, has since grown into a month-long sales campaign with major e-commerce platforms competing for consumer spending. The whole piece is worth a read on the full scale of the diminishing metrics. Sales declined from May 26 to June 21, with all major Chinese brands except Huawei posting double-digit drops as fewer promotions compared to last year weighed on demand. The Mate 80 also performed well, supported by promotions.
Apple wasn't unscathed, of course, but did better on a relative basis.
These metrics are just the beginning. Not just in the smartphone space, but soon will be seen in computers, laptops, and all manner of electronic gadgets worldwide. All manner of local compute growth, which is critical for the AI mainframe to local computing barbell I've long discussed. Apple continues to enjoy relative advantages, but is not immune overall. And we'll of course keep track of it all this AI tech way for the quarters ahead,
until it abates and slash or turns.
Stay tuned. Note the discussions here are for information purposes only, and not meant as investment advice at any time.
Thanks for joining us here.
Up next, sixth from Joao de Vivre.
A short list of things bringing joie. Bonjour, bonjour, mes amis, and I am writing this in a panic because due to me going to Marrakesh on Saturday, I am currently cramming writing 4 posts into 3 days, which is fairly stressful, but worry not, achievable.
I cannot tell you how much I am looking forward to a mini break.
Honestly, so much.
All of my kids have been away on short breaks already this summer, and I have watched from afar well via Life 3 and Sim 60 as they eat, drink, and be merry without me in the sunshine. But now, it's my turn.
My WhatsApp group with my friends Karen and Bibai, who I am travelling with, is constantly beeping with TikToks, links and reels, and I can confirm that there will be no inch uncovered in our quest to make the very, very most of our 4 days away. I am actually super excited to report back to you all, and I'll write a full itinerary of what we did and where we went when I return.
I have a selection of Marrakesh floaty dresses and trousers to pack so that I'll fit right in, and I am particularly excited to visit Jardin Majorelle, which is the garden created by Jacques Majorelle, and that was bought and renovated by Yves Saint Laurent and Pierre Burgess in the 80s.
I've also been applying fake tan like a madwoman, but sadly it's not my forte.
It's a good one to get in a golden glow gradual tan, so really, I shouldn't be able to get it wrong, but I have managed to make my legs look as though I've just waded through a tough mudder course and my feet have flip-flop marks. In years past, I would have jumped on a sunbed, but now those days are gone and I need to get with the program.
I can remember when I was 16 going on the sunbed at the local leisure centre every day for a week before I went off on girls' holidays with not a care in the world. In fact, you could rent sunbeds to have in your bedroom for months if you really wanted to look sunbaked.
I don't think we even knew what UV meant. Baked is actually the correct term in retrospect after lying on those 80s tubes.
As is cooked, singed and roasted.
But back to my list of joie, and I have lots to tell you about this week, including canapes that look like they've come straight from a smart hotel, but in fact take 5 minutes, plus while I'm getting yet another tattoo.
Here's a little rundown of what I've watched, bought, worn, read, eaten, and lusted after in the last fortnight.
You'll get an 8 extra posts every month, plus my entire archive, including tons of recipes and travel write-ups, plus all my plans, mood boards, and inspiration for my new home renovation.
I would thoroughly recommend.
And then,
7th from Home Therapy TM with Michelle Obinane.
Dated.
My ruggable edit.
I've been thinking about how the ruggable edit has shifted, and the most interesting part is the subtle rebalancing under the hood. The core rub lineup stayed the same,
but a few designs were retired to make room for new pieces that lean warmer and softer, especially the Cameron in Rose and its outdoor sibling, Cameron Sunset. Those two share a heritage-inspired pattern, but they are deliberately aged in tone, pulling in blush coral and muted terracotta alongside the usual lavender, green, and blue. What's clever is how the edit now treats indoor and outdoor spaces as a single narrative. The rose-domed Cameron will anchor a living room refresh, while the sunset version slides into the garden, echoing the same palette that's already showing up in new plantings and weather pots.
It's a quiet way of blurring the threshold, letting colour and mood flow from floor to patio.
In the author's own home, the shift is tangible. Two former living room rugs have been lifted upstairs to become bedroom focal points, and the living room gets a fresh floor-up makeover. The new rugs aren't just decorative, they're meant to stitch together the story of a space that evolves with the people living in it. If you're curious to see the full list or grab one of the pieces, the website micheliogandane.com has everything: organized books, the club, workbooks, free home therapy TM downloads, and the Amazon shop all in one place. It's a reminder that a thoughtful floor can be a simple, health-boosting pivot for any home.
Next,
8th from the register. Media over quick can scale real-time streaming and carry the world's vids. You know how we've been talking about the limitations of WebRTC for large-scale video conferencing?
Well, there's this new technology called Media over Quick, or MoQ, that's trying to bridge the gap between WebRTC and Dash.
MoQ uses Quick as the underlying transport protocol, but it's not just about transmitting media, it's about scaling real-time streaming to support massive numbers of receivers. MoQ occupies a middle ground between WebRTC and Dash, and it's designed to offer latency closer to that of WebRTC with the scalability to support massive numbers of receivers. It uses lightweight streams of Quick to ensure that different parts of a media stream can be sent independently of each other, and it has an associated priority that can be used to make decisions about which streams to transmit and which to terminate. One of the interesting things about MoQ is that it captures the idea of application layer framing, which was proposed back in 1990. The application defines objects that represent units of video that can be independently decoded and prioritizes those objects based on their importance.
The relay nodes don't have to understand the application at all, they just use the metadata to relay objects in a way that benefits the application.
MoQ is still evolving, but it's got the weight of major industry players behind it, and there's reason to be optimistic about its future.
The implementation of a relay function in large-scale deployments like Cloudflare indicates the industry investment in MoQ, and it suggests that the idea of trying to replicate the success of CDNs for real-time streams might have traction.
Up next,
9th from XDA developers.
Now, I know what you're thinking. Arduino
and Raspberry Pi are two different beasts. How can you make one out of the other?
But here's the thing. It's not about replacing the hardware, it's about rewriting the firmware to mimic the Arduino Pi, so you can use your Pi as an Arduino in your project.
TES.
Pi ZZA turns your spare Raspberry Pi 0W and 2W into an Arduino.
So I was reading about this project called Pi ZZA, and it's basically a software that lets you repurpose your old Raspberry Pi 0W or 0TW as an Arduino board. It's still a Raspberry Pi under the hood, but it'll behave like an Arduino, which is pretty cool.
Come then.
10th from the register.
Microsoft intros tech that rebuilds dead PCs without requiring local copies of Windows.
Hey,
I just read about this new Microsoft thing called Cloud Rebuild. It lets you re-image a Windows PC without needing a physical copy of Windows 11.
They're using Windows Update to download the target image and the device's drivers so the PC comes back fully functional.
It's like a normal Windows installation, but instead of using a USB drive or a custom image, it's all done through the cloud.
The process starts with the out-of-box experience, where you choose your language, time zone, and persona.
If the PC is enrolled in Microsoft Entra and Intune and registered with Windows Autopilot, it'll automatically redeploy the apps and policies assigned to the user or device.
And if you've backed up your user settings, they'll be restored, and your files will be available through OneDrive once you sign in.
The catch is not all PCs can use Cloud Rebuild. You need a Windows 11 machine that's already running Windows Recovery Environment, and it needs to have a compatible networking driver pre-installed.
You also need internet access over Ethernet or Wi-Fi.
It's still in preview, so it might not work perfectly, but it's an interesting idea.
That's it for today.
Tomorrow morning, whatever the night brings,
stay curious.